I need to begin with an explanation, if not for a frank apology, for inviting us to look at something which I hope we will find quite repugnant, and that is an attempt to justify the German sterilization laws, which was published by an American, a very well-placed American, who was extremely highly regarded during the 1930s. This article was published in 1939 by Paul Popenoe, who was an early advocate of eugenics, who, together with a very wealthy financier, was able to acquire a good funding base for their pro-eugenics promotional efforts, and who acquired, were able to obtain a great deal of support for their efforts. He and his confrere published the article that I mentioned, an attempt to justify and rejoice in 6,000 sterilization procedures that had taken place in California between 1909 to 1929. And in this article, Paul Popenoe particularly emphasizes how balanced, how appropriate, and how far-thinking the Nazi program of sterilization is. Now, we can look back on this and stare in astonishment at how anybody could have regarded this as anything other than horrifying. But it's a sign of how seriously people took eugenics at the time. It was regarded as science, as real science, and therefore as reliable. And as we'll see, one of the constant claims that is made throughout this article is that the German scientists and physicians are all doing this for the highest and noblest reasons, namely the hygiene, the purification, the cleansing of the human species. And it's precisely because of this thought that this was what science was impelling individuals to, that one could overlook the horrific violation of human rights and human freedom that was taking place. And it's important for us to bear this in mind because, of course, today, although the word eugenics tends to be regarded as a term that should not be used to describe policies and practices, exactly the same kind of approach can be found in a whole variety of places throughout the world, and even the notion of eugenics is beginning to rise up again and to be regarded as an appropriate or valuable sort of thing. So it's important for us to be able to look at how historically it was able to creep in and to become a part of the mainstay of popular culture in America. I should mention that after eugenics lost its regard following World War II, Popenoe reinvented himself. That is, rather than being a promoter of eugenics, he regarded himself as a marriage counselor, became a very widespread and well-known radio and television personality, appearing regularly on such programs as the Art Linkletter Show, and was a co-founder and editor of Ladies' Home Journal. This is the case for quite a variety of individuals who were strongly supportive of the eugenics movement in the early 20th century. The most notorious figures were prosecuted in the Nuremberg trials, but those who were executed and punished with prison sentences, often that was done for political reasons, and a large number of individuals who provided, as it were, the brain power and the rationale for, and in some cases, often also some of the implementation of these practices, never suffered any kind of penalty at all, but melted quietly into the background and continued their work in less obvious forms. Marriage counseling, encouragement of various forms of birth control and voluntary sterilization. And indeed, the movement in many ways has never disappeared. It's gone quietly underground, but is beginning to find its voice yet again today. So let's take a look at this rather hideous article, the German sterilization law, beginning with his introduction. He makes no apology for defending Adolf Hitler. He admits that Hitler's thinking was probably colored by Nietzsche originally, but he says, and here Popenoe can describe Hitler as supportive of eugenics and believe, unfortunately, rightly, that this will cause many people in America to regard Hitler in a more positive light because he is a supporter of this, what was then regarded as important and valuable form of science. He goes on to describe things which are hard for us to read without staring in astonishment, defending Hitler's expressions in Mein Kampf, and statements like, only he who is sound shall be apparent. To prevent defective persons is an act dictated by the clearest light. light of reason. And then the obviously ominous but very clear statement a little further on, also from Mein Kampf, any state which devotes itself to the care of its best racial elements must someday dominate the earth. So this program of the Meisterrasse, the master race, which became a part of Nazi mythology, is firmly based in the mythological science, the pseudoscience of eugenics. And in the text of the German sterilization law, we need not look at this in detail, but notice who is being sterilized in section number 1. And this is not just in Germany. Very similar kinds of prescriptions are found throughout the United States. Congenital feeble-mindedness, that is, low intelligence, which is regarded as inheritable, in an age where the precise mechanisms of inheritance were not understood. Schizophrenia, people with mental disorders that resulted in hallucinations and periodic dissociation from reality. And again, in an era where the precise diagnosis of schizophrenia was very much a variable from institution to institution. Manic depressive persons, epileptics, people with Huntington's chorea, which is a hereditary disease, people with hereditary blindness or deafness, or severe hereditary malformation. What constitutes a severe malformation? A club foot? A hare lip? Or anyone with severe alcoholism? So notice how horrifyingly widespread the potential for enforced sterilization was. Everything from easily treatable illnesses today, things like epilepsy, a manic depressive illness, alcoholism, undefined malformations, to say nothing of blindness and deafness. These were legitimate reasons, according to the policy of the National Socialists, for sterilizing a person, and Papineau is encouraging people to read this and regard this as a model that could be followed. Now, again, we look back on this and think, this man must have been an extremist. Surely no one listened to him. In fact, he was listened to very closely, and he had a very large number of strong supporters, as we'll see. Now, if we drop down past the form of this law to number 3, which I've marked in dark blue, and again, these are my own commentaries on the article, Section 3, Implementation of the German Sterilization Law. One of the interesting points for us, I think, is the fact that he notes, if you go down to the text that's highlighted in white in the second paragraph, about one-third of the inmates of mental institutions are being certified for sterilization. So one-third of people confined to mental institution were regarded as candidates for sterilization, not voluntary sterilization either, but also of interest. He says this provision is a particular aid to Roman Catholics who have been combating the sterilization law. So Papineau admits that the Catholic Church is the one strong voice against this law in Germany. Although Hitler himself is a Roman Catholic, the Church, as everyone knows, has been the source of a large part of his opposition, and it has taken a strong stand against sterilization in Germany. And so, and we'll conclude with this in another observation, in Germany, during the rise of National Socialism, a conscience exemption was permitted to Roman Catholics who refused to participate in activities that violated their conscience. I hope this causes us to scratch our heads and wonder at the fact that even Hitler himself was willing to grant conscience exemptions to Catholics who objected to providing services that violated their conscience in an era such as our own, where people are seriously questioning whether such conscience exemptions are permissible. Well, notice number 1, no Catholic judge should be asked to sit on a sterilization court, no surgeon is required to perform an operation. And notice in a rather cynical way that a Catholic who is liable to sterilization won't be sterilized as long as they remain in an institution at the expense of their family or of the church. So there is no government assistance to people who, quote, should be sterilized, unquote, unless they have wealthy relatives or unless the church is willing to provide institutions to protect them. And indeed, the church did provide orphanages to try to protect people from this terrible scourge. He mentions an individual, Dr. Hermann Muckermann, who was a Roman Catholic eugenics promoter and a Jesuit, who later stepped back from and was refused permission by the National Socialists to continue publishing. He was, I'm sorry to say, a promoter of eugenics, but he opposed the movement in Germany when it began to extend eugenics to extermination of races, thank goodness. If we drop down now to the final sections, again, hard for us to imagine, but this is acceptable to Papadeau and indeed to many of his readers because it is scientific leadership that is more and more prominent in their councils. And this should cause us a kind of a note of caution. When politicians claim that they are doing things for the very best of scientific reasons and that indeed they have the best of scientists advising them, we ought to listen very carefully to and look very closely at what it is they're doing. Because science can be used as a justification for all kinds of acts that are themselves morally repugnant. An administration based, frankly and determinedly, on the principles of eugenics is, at least in Papineau's notion, a positive thing and an acceptable thing. Again, a cautionary tale for us and a reminder of the fact that the language of science can be used to rationalize many horrifying things.